I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. Today, we focus on news from the Maryland General Assembly as it rumbles towards sine-die on Monday, the final day of the 2018 session. Supporters of the omnibus crime bill call it a bipartisan effort to target repeat felons and expand violence intervention programs like Safe Streets. Joshua Harris and the Reverend Kobe Little from the Maryland chapter of the NAACP call the bill's reliance on mandatory minimums a throwback to the failed policies in the 1990s. They join me in Studio A. And Brian Sears from the Daily Record has a status report on what's likely to pass and what's likely to fail as the legislative session enters its final days. Plus, a preview of an opera at Morgan State University based on the life and loves of the great poet Paul Laurence Dunbar. Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall on this Friday. Today, it's the Midday News Wrap. The Maryland General Assembly wraps up its 2018 session on Monday at midnight. And so far, more than 3,100 bills have been introduced in this session. Today, a tally on what legislation is passed and what is likely to pass or fail between now and sine die. As is always the case in Annapolis, there's a flurry of legislative activity just as the session is about to end. Coming up, Brian Sears of the Daily Record will have an update on the latest from the State House on this, the second to last official day of the session. But first, a look at one of the bills that has emerged as one of the most controversial. Senate Bill 122, otherwise known as the Comprehensive Crime Bill of 2018. It calls for increasing penalties for certain crimes, including mandating penalties for crimes involving a firearm, calls for funding of the anti-crime initiative Safe Streets, and it establishes a task force to study statutes related to gangs. Yesterday in the Daily Record newspaper, a group of 15 local law professors argued that the bill is unconstitutional. It is opposed for other reasons by several other groups, including Baltimore's Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle and the NAACP. Joshua Harris is Director of Communications for the NAACP Maryland State Conference. He's also a former mayoral candidate in Baltimore City. And the Reverend Kobe Little is Director of Political Action for the Maryland NAACP. And they join me here in Studio A. It's good to see you both. Welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
So, Reverend Little, let me start with you. Tell me what's in this bill as you understand it, and then we'll find out why what's in the bill is not something you can support.
Okay. So the bill is basically broken down into a number of different sections: punishments, prohibitions, procedure, and programs. And so I'll kind of go through what those are and some of the changes that have been made in the House Judiciary Committee. But the bill, as it came over to the House from the Senate, the punishment included firearm and trafficking crimes, enhanced sentences for the mandatory minimums already in the law, firearm and crimes of violence or felonies, obstructing justice, and wearing, carrying, or transporting a handgun. The prohibitions, possession of a firearm with previous conviction, crime of violence and subsequent offenders, and volume dealers. The procedures were wiretapping, appeal rights for the state's attorney's office, and drug evaluation and treatment. And then the programs were a number of intervention programs to stop violence.
Things like Safe Streets, for example.
Things like Safe Streets.
Yeah.
But before we get into the things in the bill that have caused us to oppose the Senate bill, the first thing that we'd like to say is that the process is objectionable. Essentially, this comprehensive omnibus bill is not a comprehensive or omnibus bill. It's just a Franken bill. It's a compilation of bad ideas tied to good ideas in an attempt to get some of those bad ideas passed into law. There is no proof that mandatory minimums deters crime or stops violence. And the idea that in order to pass funding for programs like Safe Streets, we also have to swallow the pill of enhanced mandatory minimums, it doesn't make sense.
And right. So there are things that a lot of folks, you included, do support, like Safe Streets, which has been proven by an awful lot of data to be a very effective crime intervention strategy. But Joshua Harris, research, and there is plenty of research that shows that mandatory minimums, for example, do nothing to stop violence and crime. Mm-hmm. What will stop violence and crime?
Well, that's exactly the problem with the bill. It's not based in any statistical research. And we know that if we're going to address crime, the root cause is poverty, right? And so if we take people who are currently committing bad acts off the streets, if the conditions still exist, they will simply be replaced by a new crop of individuals who are growing up in those conditions, right? And so they will take part in those activities. And so we have to invest in community-based programming, like we heard even at Baltimore City at the budget hearing the other day about the city budget. We have to begin to invest in education, in housing, and in programs that are grassroots-based and run by community to really change the conditions and invest in community and invest in people rather than being reactionary and investing in the sentencing after the fact.
Yeah, because this bill, as you outlined, Reverend Little, you know, it has to do with prosecutorial conduct, what they're allowed to do, what they're not allowed to do, and it does have mandatory minimums. Again, taking the imprimatur away from judges and putting it in the hands of the legislature. So the judge's hands are tied. Mm-hmm. You know, the city of Baltimore, including the city council, passed a mandatory minimum bill itself. And I, as you understand, this is a reaction, I think, to people who want sort of immediate action. I don't think anybody disagrees that poverty is at the root cause of this. But the governor is saying, for example, that, you know, the average person who's arrested for a felony has had interactions or even arrests averaging 9 times. These are repeat offenders, that he says the only way to safe in the streets is to get these people off the streets and in prison.
So we all deserve to live in safe and secure communities free of violence, and we all want that. And people who oppose this bill and organizations that oppose Senate Bill 122 aren't saying that criminals have a right to roam the streets or that we don't think that safety and security are important. What we're saying is that this legislation doesn't address the problem. As Josh alluded, there's a violence ecosystem that produces the violent actors. If you don't alter that equation, you can remove one set of violent actors and it's always going to be replaced by another. In the 90s, the murder rate in Baltimore, the number of murders per year was 300 plus. That was 2 decades ago. The people who were the bad actors then are not the bad actors today. But there's been nothing done to fundamentally change the equation or dismantle the violence ecosystem. So what we're saying is a true comprehensive approach identifies first and foremost that we're talking about an economic justice issue. If people don't have jobs, if they don't have safe and secure housing, if they don't have opportunities for education and health care, then it creates stressors that amplify the conflicts in the community. And if they're not equipped with the tools to address those conflicts in peaceable ways, then there's going to be violence. And the truth of the matter is that, like I said, everybody deserves to be safe in their communities. Many people in communities impacted by violence don't feel safe, and they've taken their safety into their own hands. And it's unreasonable to expect that if there are guns in the community, they won't be used. And so the police have not been able to make a lot of people feel safe and secure, and they've taken that into their own hands. So we need intervention programs, one that train the police to be true partners with communities so that they can establish trusting relationships so that people feel safe, but two, also to help people decompress from all of the stressors that drive the violence. That's not sufficient if we don't give people mm-hmm. economic opportunity. You know, yeah, I just add one last point. There's a lot being said about violence driving business and opportunity away from Baltimore. The first people who need business and opportunity, the first people who need it are the people who are most impacted by the violence. And if we speak to the issue there in the communities that are most...
Who are in those neighborhoods that are not safe as a general rule. And Josh Harris, what then would be a good outcome? What are you talking to legislators about? I mean, for example, Safe Streets is a part of the bill that you support. Is there a chance that folks are open to the notion of denuding the bill of some of these other things, the mandatory minimums and some of the prosecutorial restraints, and including, you know, keeping Safe Streets, for example?
Well, that's more so where the political end of it comes into play. The fact that the bill was bundled in such a way to where we're saying we're going to dangle this carrot of funding programs that have been proven effective to you, but only if you buy into this that we have no data and no statistics to back up. In fact, so much so that when Senator Zirkin was testifying, one of the places they referenced—
This is Bobby Zirkin from Baltimore County. He's a Democrat, yes. And he and the governor are working together in this. They both, you know, both of them are calling this a bipartisan effort, which you know, they claim is a good thing.
Yes, and one of the places that they referenced was places like Chicago, where they've increased mandatory minimums, and they said that they've had legislation in place like this in Chicago since 2005, if I remember correctly, on that. I'm from Chicago originally. I understand the violence that exists in Chicago, now living in Baltimore, I understand the parallels, but yet we know that violence in Chicago has not been reduced. So if it has not been effective in Chicago, then why would we do something similar here in Baltimore and the state of Maryland as a whole? And so it's really problematic that they would tie positive things like funding of safe streets, witness relocation funds to protect witnesses, people who want to come forward and testify against crimes, to things that have not been proven to be effective. And so that's kind of the problem, that it's just this bundle deal. And so there is also other legislation that has been put forward this session that would fund safe streets as well as witness relocation separately from this bill. Right. But yet this—
So you are encouraging legislators to vote no on this bill.
Well, as it stands now, you know, it's an ever-evolving process, mm-hmm. and if there are the appropriate amendments, then it might be something that we could support. But as it stands now, no. I mean, one of the amendments that we've suggested that has yet to make it into the bill is a commission on peace building and dismantling the violence ecosystem that would bring together stakeholders from across the spectrum to really get the data, what's driving the violence. And once we know what's driving the violence, then we can talk about how we eliminate and eradicate the violence. But, you know, to Josh's point, this bill, Senate Bill 122, came from the Senate side and was bundled into one kind of gargantuan, monstrous, bad bill. But funding for safe streets and other programs has actually originated on the House side, is actually in the Senate now, making its way through the budget.
So that is a separate bill. So legislators will have the opportunity to vote for that bill
right.
and vote against this one, this so-called omnibus.
Assuming it makes it out of committee.
Yeah.
Assuming that they make get out of committee. And it's a complicated and political process. But what we would say is, if you believe that safe streets and other programs like the victim and witness protection programs should be funded, then call your legislators who sit on the Budget and Tax Committee and tell them you'd like to see that bill come before the full Senate and pass the Senate. It's already passed the House.
Yeah, of course, Josh Harris, we've got to finish up here, but the racial equity lens of this shows that when it comes to things like mandatory minimums, by and large, most of the people affected by that kind of statute are going to be people of color.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that we, of course, know that Associated Black Charities a couple years ago put out 10 questions to make sure that the policies that we're putting in place, we're viewing them from a racial equity lens and how they're going to impact those minority communities. And that's something that I don't think has been used when they're looking at this legislation. And again, coming back to the fact that keeping people in jail longer does not change the conditions that poverty or that crime is thriving in, right? And that is key to really change the narrative and make sure that we're working to rehabilitate individuals. And there hasn't been anything put in this legislation that will do that. And there's been talks of folks who would like to see an anti-violence curriculum put into schools to begin to have conflict resolution and things discussed regularly, to put that at the forefront of our young people's mind. And those are really things that are going to begin to change the way that people view violence and conflict in their community.
Yeah, and as always, it's going to be a hustle to the finish, because Sine Die is Monday night at midnight. So we'll see. But I appreciate both of you coming by and explaining your position. I wish you all the best of luck as you continue this fight. All right, Reverend Kobe Little, he's the Director of Political Action from the NAACP Maryland State Conference. Joshua Harris is the Director of Communications. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, more on the status of many other bills that are winding their way through the General Assembly. The Daily Record's Brian Sears joins me with the latest from Annapolis. We'll take your calls and comments, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, we're going to dip into the Midday Archives for one of our favorite Midday on Ethics episodes. Dr. Jeff Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, will join me for a conversation about informed consent and the story of Baltimore's own Henrietta Lacks. That's coming up Monday on Midday. If you're just joining us today for the Midday News Wrap, we're focusing on the latest from the Maryland General Assembly. The final day of the session, known as Sine Die, is Monday. Brian Sears joins us on the line from the State House in Annapolis. He covers government and politics for the Daily Record. Hey, Brian, how you doing?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversations, if you have any questions for Brian Sears about what's happening in this last few days of the general session, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. So, Brian, let's talk a little bit now about Senate Bill 122, the bill we were just talking about with Reverend Little and Josh Harris. As far as you know, what is the status of this bill? Where does it stand at this juncture? And do you expect a vote on the bill that they described, or do you expect a vote on an altered bill at some point?
Look, I think we're going to see an altered bill that's going to come out of the House, which means that there's going to be some work for a conference committee between the House and the Senate, likely on Monday, as if the legislators need one more thing to do on the last day of session. It looks like the House is going to stick with some of the changes that they've made, including reducing the amount of time that one has to serve on certain felonies that are involved with a handgun. They've also removed a provision that allows prosecutors to appeal certain decisions about bringing in of evidence. And so I think that you're probably going to see some discussion between the House and the Senate on that, and probably some kind of a compromise package sometime, hopefully before midnight on Monday.
And there's a financial component to this as well, right? These mandatory minimums and stuff like that they're calling for in this bill, there is a cost associated with some of this.
Well, there's a cost associated with everything, but the financial component and the part that the House has jointly referred to the Appropriations Committee really deals with some of the funding components related to issues like safe streets that were brought up by your earlier guests.
One of the things that has happened already is bills have passed, the governor has vetoed them, and then the legislature has stepped right back up and overridden the vetoes. One concerned a bill that makes it hard to suspend or fire people in the education system, teachers and principals and folks like that, superintendents. That didn't get as much attention as the one that concerns the Board of Public Works and their involvement in the process of securing funding for capital improvements to schools. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, you know, this is about a 50-year-old process that really has gained some attention in the last 4 years or so because of the activism of Comptroller Peter Franchot, along with the support of Governor Larry Hogan. It has rankled lawmakers, and it has really irritated school superintendents who feel like they have been treated harshly at times when they've been brought before the Board of Public Works, and the two have called them to task on things like air conditioning in high schools, or the decisions about which schools are going to be replaced, or even mold in classrooms like we saw a couple of years ago in Howard County. And so the legislature has been looking for years to try to find a way to curb the activism of the board, and this year they finally decided to take the steps to essentially remove all of the oversight authority and approval authority of the Board of Public Works and move it strictly into a commission called the Interagency Commission on School Construction, which means that the comptroller and the governor will essentially be out of any sort of direct control.
And the governor is basically saying that this leaves the state open to graft, corruption, undue influence from outside sources. How would, if the governor's most dire predictions come true, how would that work?
Yeah, look, no one's too sure about that. I mean, I think the primary concerns that the governor has expressed are that the way that they've used the board in the past is to bring school systems in to answer questions. They see this as an accountability tool. A lot of their questions focus on, you know, many times on, you know, how are you spending the state's money? They ask a lot of maintenance questions, and they frequently want to know why school systems are not sort of taking care of the schools that states, you know, spend tens and hundreds of millions of dollars every year to fund. And so I think they're concerned about, you know, giving the legislature more of a say on this panel. It does dilute the governor's authority when you are one of three and you have an ally on the board like Peter Francio. It dilutes your power then to put it into a panel that nine members, where four of those members are going to be selected by the legislature. You'll get four direct picks, and then there's the school superintendent, the state school superintendent.
And when it comes to that process, is the bill specific about, you know, when it comes to when you said the legislature is going to pick four people? I mean, who does that mean? Mike Miller and Mike Bush pick four people, or is there some sort of committee process?
That's exactly what that means. That means the presiding officers, and in this case, assuming they win re-election and become the presiding officers next year, that will put Miller and Bush in charge of selecting the two members that go on the board.
Yeah, because we remember last year, just around this time or a little bit later perhaps, into the school year, in Baltimore County, there were all those classrooms that were overheated, and basically the governor and Mr. Francio were telling Kevin Kamenetz that he had to install air conditioners in buildings. And Mr. Kamenetz was saying, you know, we don't want to install air conditioners in buildings that may be fully renovated with new cooling systems. And they had a big fight, and everybody saw that as a prelude to the fact that Mr. Kamenetz, who is now, in fact, a candidate for governor, that this was a political circus that that the governor and Mr. Kamenetz engaged in that really had very little to do with air conditioning and a lot more to do with politics.
Yeah, except for the fact that this really has been going on for the last 3 years, and it's involved in other school systems. But certainly, you can't divorce the politics from the politics here, which is that, you know, the county executive who I covered for a long time is running for governor, and certainly everybody is looking for a stick with which they can whack their opponent on. But the fact of the matter is that you've seen Francio and Hogan do this over the last 3 years. So there's also a legitimate component where they have used this in their view to bring transparency and accountability to the school funding system, which can often be sort of an unwieldy beast at times. The school systems are often outside of the reach of other accountability measures.
Brian Sears joins us from just outside the State House in Annapolis. He covers government and politics for the Daily Record. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. Our number here at Midday, if you have a question or a comment for Brian Sears, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And to find us in the Twittersphere, @MiddayWIPR. Let's go to the phones, Brian. This is Diana from Baltimore County. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi, Brian. How you doing? My name is Diana. I'm one of the main advocates for Lansdowne High School here in Baltimore County. And I just wanted to actually thank you. A few days ago, you gave us the opportunity to visually see on social media the transparency of the decisions what our delegates and our legislators were actually having discussions. And one of the part that really bothers me about this whole decision that's been made with the 21st Century School Facilities Act is that we haven't been able to see all the hard work that's going on in that behind-the-scenes debate. Like, we could listen in when we call, but we can't see who's talking unless you're familiar with the individuals that are speaking. So you gave us a light of that sunshine of what I call transparency that a lot of the voters and the parents and advocates like myself would want to see more of. And that's one of the big concerns that we have.
All right. Well, Diana, I appreciate
we won't get that chance to do that during the new process.
All right. I appreciate the call, Diana. Brian, you want to respond to clearly a fan of yours in Baltimore County?
You know, it's weird to have a reporter to have a fan. Look, I'll say you're welcome, and I'm just doing my job.
That's right. Don't get used to it now. Don't get used to it. That's right. speaking of this veto, there was a senator, Senator Muse, who decided not to vote, and you were tweeting about this. What does it mean that a person just didn't register a vote, a senator who was on the floor at the time the vote was taken, and didn't cast a vote for yay or nay to override the governor's veto? What's that all about?
Well, it is sort of a violation of the rules without any penalty. There is a without getting too nerdy, there is a specific provision in Senate rules that requires that when members are on the floor, unless they are for some reason excused, and there are a number of reasons why one can be excused, the most likely is that you have a particular conflict of interest. So unless you're excused, you are required to vote. The rules say the member shall vote on any question that is before the chamber when you're on the floor. And so he didn't vote, and what he told me was essentially that he liked some of the things that the legislation did, specifically providing extra money to school construction. But one of the things he didn't like were the provisions that made it political, and so he opted not to. And you know, that is in fact a violation of the rules.
Let's talk about health insurance. The governor did sign a bill to help stabilize the health insurance markets in Maryland. What will this bill do, and how will it accomplish it?
Well, they're hoping that what it'll do is it will help stabilize the rates and keep people in the market at least for another year while everybody looks to find sort of a longer-term solution with the federal ACA. One of the concerns that was had was that with all the changes that were made at the federal level, you were going to see a lot of people getting out of the market, and that was going to cause gigantic increases in rates. What the governor and legislative leaders are hoping, at least for now, is that this bill will provide sort of a stabilizing hand until a longer-term solution can be found. And I think everybody agrees that a longer-term solution is going to be needed.
All right, so they're going to create sort of a reinsurance program that can be kind of a stopgap measure. And, of course, people leaving the pool of applicants for coverage under the ACA prompted by the tax legislation that the Republican Congress passed last December, no longer making it mandatory for people to insure themselves. So we will have to see how that plays out. It's interesting politically, Senator Mike Miller, the president of the Senate, he's the longest serving president of the Senate and legislator in history of Maryland, and the longest serving in the country at this point, some 30 plus years. There's a rally on Monday that's going to be sponsored and produced by a union, the SEIU Union, the Service Employees International Union, to try to overthrow the king. They're saying they want to end Miller time. What's that all about?
And it's interesting because it's really just being done by one chapter of SEIU. There have been a number of other chapters that have in the last couple of weeks sent emails to the Senate president assuring them that they are not they're not involved in certain aspects of what's going on here. But SEIU 500 is particularly upset that the Senate president, they feel that the Senate president has blocked legislation that they advocate for. Specifically, one of the bills that they really wanted to get done this year was a bill that would allow adjunct professors to collectively bargain. And that bill failed again this year and was withdrawn by the sponsor. The Senate president says that he thinks that the union blames him for it. The union certainly seems to blame him for that, and they see him as being an anti-labor vote. There are a number of labor supporters that have come out pretty strongly for the Senate president over the years and see him as anything but anti-labor. The interesting thing is that this is going to be so public on the last day of session out in front of the State House, where they're clearly going after one of the three most powerful men in Annapolis and in an election year. So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out, not only over the course of the election, but also assuming that the Senate president is elected and returned to his position.
And we should mention that Mr. Miller does have a primary opponent. That's a rarity for him, a gentleman named Tommy Makila. He's 47 years old. He's an energy analyst. He lives in Akakit, and he's originally from Finland, and he's basically saying that Senate president, who has served as longer as Senate president than anybody else in the country, just simply has too much power. We're just talking about this school construction bill. He has consolidated yet a little bit more power with that veto override. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But Mr. Miller is not the only person facing opposition, leading Democrats. I mean, Senator Joan Carter Conway, Bobby Zirkin, who's a sponsor of this omnibus crime bill, Barbara Robinson, Nathaniel McFadden.
It's interesting that some of the senior leadership of the Democrats are facing challenges from within.
Yeah, and a number of people who, you know, who watch these things sort of point to this and say it's an indication of the weakening of Mike Miller, that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you would have never seen these kinds of challenges, that this was, you know, that this was the benefit of incumbency and being part of Miller's team. And what you're seeing, that, you know, what you're seeing this year is a lot of younger people, very progressive, not willing to wait their turn and stepping up and primarying entrenched incumbents, and that's something we're not used to seeing. It has the potential to really sort of change the face of the Senate in some ways. I mean, some of these challenges should probably be taken fairly seriously.
On medical marijuana, the Legislative Black Caucus made that a big priority. The bill that they had hoped to pass at the very closing minutes of the session last year failed to get through. It was SB 2, Bill Number 2. And in January, before the session started, when I spoke with Delegate Cheryl Glenn, who's now the outgoing chair of the Maryland Legislative Black Caucus, she said that she expected to have a bill on the governor's desk by the end of January. So here we are in the middle of April, 4 days from the end of the session, and there ain't no bill on the governor's desk. Where is that headed?
It looks like it's going to head to conference committee. There's some pretty big differences between the House and the Senate. The differences are fairly similar to where we were last year with the number of licenses for growers and processors, a provision that reserves two of the licenses for growers to two licensees who were bumped off the original list of 15. These were things that the Senate added into the bill that the House of Delegates did not want in the bill last year. And so we are sort of back to where we were last year. I'm being told that the legislative Black Caucus supports a lot of these amendments, but the problem is that, you know, there seemed to be an agreement last year going into the last minutes of the session last year, and in the end that bill still couldn't get done. So, you know, there really is sort of the concern from people that maybe this doesn't get done again this year. Based on how fast this got a hearing at the beginning of the year, I still think you're likely to walk out of here with something.
It's interesting to see that, you know, the political strategy that they employed, that the Legislative Black Caucus employed. Last summer, they were saying they were demanding a special session to take up medical marijuana, and that if a special session weren't granted, they were going to sort of withhold their support of generally agreed upon Democratic initiatives. They were trying to pressure Senate President Miller and Delegate Bush to do something immediately. That pressure doesn't seem to have really produced any particular results, although they, as you say, they may end up with a bill at the midnight hour, literally on Monday.
Well, we have not seen the Legislative Black Caucus actually flex their muscle with respect to blocking some of the leadership priorities. But, you know, we're coming into the last day of the last days of the session, you know, especially coming into Monday. That power could be, you know, just a little bit bigger on the last day. And if they feel like this is being dragged out, it's entirely possible that you could see them step up. But at this point, we haven't seen them vocally oppose any of the legislative priorities of either the House or the Senate leaders.
You've been thinking a little bit about one that's really been under the radar. This is legalized sports betting. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court involving betting in New Jersey. How does that relate to Maryland and what Maryland may do?
Well, you know, Maryland is looking at this case. Maryland got on board with an amicus brief. The governor's office backed it. And really what a lot of lawmakers would like to do down here is to pass a bill that would allow the state to get this issue on the ballot in the event that there is a favorable Supreme Court decision. We may know something no later than June on this, although I think a lot of lawmakers think we're probably going to hear something in the next couple of weeks. So this is all contingent on what happens down in D.C. The catch here is the difference, again, between the House and the Senate. Both sides want to get it on the ballot, but the House wants to pass a bill that would put specific venues in that could take sports betting, specifically the casinos and the racetracks. And the Senate really wants to come back and work those details out. next year after they get it on the ballot and get it passed. The concern here really is the clock. Everybody seems to think the Supreme Court is going to strike down the federal law that bans sports betting, and you have a number of other states, including Pennsylvania, that are gearing up to do this. And so I think everybody wants to get Maryland on board early rather than behind everyone else. And because we have to do this through the ballot, if they miss this opportunity in 2018, it really would be two more years before they could get it on the ballot, and then perhaps an additional year before they could work out all the details and get sports betting into Maryland.
You know, and generally speaking, when they talk about putting initiatives on the ballot, it's because they're pretty confident that it's going to pass, right? So they're doing this thinking that the voters will, in fact, support legalization of sports betting in Maryland.
And there have been some polls to show that there is strong support for sports betting, but there's also a legal requirement here because the way that we did sports gaming, we did video lottery terminals in 2007, and we wrote it into the Constitution. Now, just about every change that you make to gaming when you want to add a new component has to go to the voters because it is a change to the Maryland Constitution.
Yeah, and given the series that the Orioles had in Houston, I wouldn't necessarily suggest betting on the Orioles, although they did win. They broke the losing streak. They did win yesterday, I guess it was. Just real quick as we finish up, Brian, the money from casinos being put in a lockbox for education, that is a done deal, is it not?
We're going to get something. There's going to be a there's going to be a ballot question because, again, the legislators want this to go on the ballot, again, because it's tied into gaming, but they also want it to be something that is ironclad and that could not be undone through a statute or simply changing the law year to year in budget language. And so we're going to get something that sort of more permanently writes this into the state law. The interesting thing to note is it's a significant chunk of the budget as they phase it in. I mean, over the course of 5 years, it's going to be the difference of $500 million coming out of the general fund budget.
One quick question about politics before we let you go and get back to doing your job. It's interesting, for example, there was a vote by Delegate Pat McDonough, a Republican, who is also running for Baltimore County Executive on the Republican primary ballot there. He voted against the Republican caucus and voted to override the veto of the school construction bill. Any other votes surprise you, or did that vote in particular, did that raise some eyebrows in Annapolis?
I think it raised some eyebrows, but it doesn't. I haven't had a chance to talk directly with Delegate McDonough, but it doesn't necessarily cut across the boundaries of wow, that's shocking, because he has disagreed with the governor, and they don't get along very well. The governor has backed Al Redmer, the Maryland Insurance Commissioner, who is running for Baltimore County Executive in a primary against Pat McDonough, and so there's a little bit of bad blood there, and so perhaps that vote in light of the politics makes a little more sense.
It does indeed. And you are always making sense, Mr. Sears. You are a font of wisdom, erudition, and experience, and we appreciate your taking the time to step outside and make sure you got a good cell phone connection to talk to us today. So thank you very much. Enjoy this last crazy weekend, and get some rest before midnight on Monday.
Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Brian Sears covers the General Assembly for the Daily Record. Coming up after a break, the opera company at Morgan State University is presenting an opera called Lyrics of Sunshine and Shadows. It's based on the lives and love of the great poet Paul Laurence Dunbar. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stick around.